Radio, where gamers roll.
www.d20radio.com.
Hello and welcome to the Knowledge Check Podcast, a D&D 5th edition discussion podcast. I am one of your hosts, Eric.
And I'm your other host, Philip.
And welcome to the 11th episode of the Knowledge Check Podcast. We are returning after taking the week off for the 4th of July. So thank you for your patience. But tonight we are discussing what it's like being a GM at the table. And this discussion is going to be primarily directed at Dungeon Masters, or if you're in another system, Game Masters. And when the greatest thing that can ever happen to you happens, and one of your players goes, hey, I want to try running something, and you get to take a break, because that is just such a wonderful, wonderful moment. And it also is kind of a moment of pride, because you've gotten good enough at DMing that you've made it look easy enough to where one of your players goes, yeah, I could do that. Before we get into that discussion tonight, first, the social media plug. So, Philip, where can they find us?
Everywhere. They can find us on the Facebooks, the Google Plus, Twitter, Gmail. We got a MySpace, I think.
Yep. We got some sweet Panic at the Disco playing as soon as it loads up.
Awesome. Awesome.
If you like and review us on iTunes, we'll put you in our top 8.
Sweet. Also, Instagram.
Yes.
And Snapchat?
No.
We on Snapchat?
No. I don't know what benefit Snapchat would be to us. If you want us to be on Snapchat, let us know.
Eric will run the Snapchat.
I run everything. Philip can run the Snapchat.
Okay, Jeff can run the Snapchat. He's not here to defend himself. We'll put Jeff on the Snapchat. Plus, Jeff responds to everything on social media.
That's fair.
He's totally our fan service guy.
Yes, and you can also find us over at thegeekpantheon.com, our website, where if you want to get the episodes the very second that they drop, they show up over there. And there is also a contact us section. So if you want to drop us a line through some form that not the entire world will see, then you could do that over there or thegeekpantheon@gmail.com. We are also proudly members of the D20 Radio Podcasting Network. And if you head on over to d20radio.com, the best little gaming blog on the interwebs, you will find all kinds of wonderful content for your gaming needs, regardless of system that you play in. If you're in a few different types of games, they've got stuff for pretty much everything over there. But if you're going there for your D&D 5e needs, you can head on over there and check out Ben Erickson's article from the 4th of July, because Ben's a real professional and doesn't take federal holidays off. And he has an article in his series titled The Workshop, where he does a character build. He built Karen, Priestess of the Celestial Truth, which is a gold dragonborn cleric of light at 5th level. So if you're just looking for some inspiration for an NPC that you want to include, or you're building a character and are kind of at a loss, you want to try something different and out there, go check out a lady dragon that shoots fire. Well, at least that's what the picture looks like. Sacred fire, I suppose. It's a great article. Ben has given complete descriptions of all the spells, a history of the character, personality traits. It's a really extensively well-done character. Also, if you head over to d20radio.com in the podcast section, you will find all of our fellow podcasts on the D20 Radio Network, including Save or Die, a classic D&D podcast. It is a podcast dedicated to the original D&D boxed set. And the most recent episode dropping last month, episode 137, DMs James Glenn and Eric look at the halfling class for the original D&D and kind of examine where it started, where it's gone. And I mean, also your ears should have perked up right there when I said the halfling class.
Yeah, I forgot about that.
So, yeah, go check out Save or Die, a classic D&D podcast, and all the other podcasts on the D20 Radio Network. Okay, Philip, let's break down some news.
Yay. So, we're
going to go
newsroom sounds.
Very, very good. It's like I'm watching CBS back in the 60s. welcome to the Knowledge Check podcast. That was my Walter Cronkite. So first up, the day that we are recording, July 10th, Mike Merles dropped a Unearthed Arcana on us for his idea that has been causing quite the stir in the D&D community when he posted it on Twitter, his Greyhawk initiative system. So basically this front loads initiative and planning and everything at the top of the round, and you do it every round. So your initiative will change. And it's
but it's not just every round. In addition to, it's going to change depending on what you want to do.
Yes. But it's a bit too dense, I feel like, to really get into it in the news section. I promise we are trying to get away from having our news segments be 30 minutes long. But just general broad strokes, I think it's interesting. I think it could help some tables out quite a bit, just because I've played at some tables where combat really slogs down because it gets to somebody's turn in the initiative order and they just freeze and they don't know what they're going to do next. This initiative system front loads all of that. You plan as a group what you're going to do, and you roll your initiative based off of what you've decided. So just really top level, not getting into all the reactions and delaying your turn and everything. If you're going to do a ranged attack, you roll a D4. If you're going to move, swap out your gear, or pretty much any other action, you take a D6, a D8 for a melee attack, and a D10 for casting a spell. I think even at this top level, there are some, I would tweak it, because I feel like casting a cantrip should take less time than casting fireball, personally. Yeah. That just makes sense to me. So kind of having your casters guaranteed to go last, just, well, not guaranteed, they could roll a one, but it hampers some of your strategizing, especially if all the bad guys are grouped up together and your caster just wants to hit them with a fireball right away, they're not likely going to be able to do that. So, Philip, when we were discussing pre-show, you had some thoughts on this initiative system. Why don't you let the people know?
I think basically the way I summed this up to you was that I like the idea of variable initiative. I don't like the way that this does variable initiative. For instance, if you've ever played Savage Worlds, that has variable initiative, but they use an initiative system that's very fast by just dealing out cards, and then you play in the order of the card that you're dealt. So there's no everybody roll and then everybody give me your numbers and then I have to order the numbers. Like, it's done very quickly.
Yeah.
And so with a very simplistic initiative system, variable works fine, and I like it in that one. But I think with D&D, initiative takes a minute, and I don't like the idea of having to do that at the beginning of every round. I also kind of dislike the idea as a player of having to predetermine my action before my turn comes around, and then potentially having to like re-roll an additional initiative thing if I change my mind. So I don't very much like that. And also, I don't like the idea of everyone sort of pausing and talking about the order we're going to go in or what we're all going to do at the beginning of the round. I rather prefer the idea of players thinking about what they're going to do as the round goes through. And by the time they get to their turn, they've decided what they're going to do.
Yeah.
So that's my, I mean, on one read and never having played with it, that's my opinion.
Yeah. So. The other kind of big, gigantic, wonderful piece of news that we got is that phases 2 and 3 of D&D Beyond have launched. Do-do-do-do.
Hooray.
So creating your own character and creating homebrew content, but more importantly, being able to view other people's homebrew content.
Yes.
And it's spells, items, and monsters. Like, you can create something and put it up there for the community to use, which is just amazing.
Yeah.
And when you look at the stats of it, it's it's intuitive. It's easy to read. It's in the format that we've come to expect from D&D 5e content. And so, yeah, I mean, I'm loving it. I've clicked through just looking at stuff that other people have created. I've tinkered around with the character builder a little bit, and it seems intuitive enough. I haven't run into any problems yet. What do you think, Philip?
I'm excited by the homebrew stuff a lot. Now, with the character creator, I also haven't gotten to spend a lot of time with it. But I will say that my big hope for this, because 4E, we got two versions of a character creator over the life of 4E. One version was a downloadable program. The other was a web app. With the downloadable program, it was possible to create and insert homebrew things into the character creator. Feats, the magic items that we were just talking about, that sort of thing. What I really want to see is that. The option to create homebrew character options and incorporate them into the character builder.
Yeah.
It doesn't seem to me like that would be very hard, but then I'm not a programmer, and so it might be. But that's what I would really like to see. As far as the homebrew content, I'm really excited by that. Depending on the price point we end up at for the subscription on this, that may be enough to sell me on this. Because the idea of being able to just, I need a monster, it's not in my monster manual, of going and searching around in one place instead of having to click over the dozens of other places that you would go to find good homebrew stuff, that's really appealing to me.
Yeah. Well, and looking at the character creator, one thing, and it's such a small little thing that just, I don't want to say bummed me out, but you have three options for the generation method of your ability scores: standard array, point buy, or manually putting them in. Obviously, the idea being that you manually roll the dice. I would have liked to have seen a dice roller built into it.
Yeah.
But that's just, if I'm looking for things to kind of say, hey, do this, mm-hmm. that's one thing that just stuck out at me. But I love the fact that when you go to build a character, they have standard character creation or quick build. I mean, if you want to do it that way, they have a random name generator built into it. So if you just want a random name, you can just click randomize and it gives you that. And you can also designate what type of advancement your campaign has, whether it's milestone or XP, whether or not your campaign uses the encumbrance rules, and how your hit points increase. So I like it. I think mm-hmm. it's good. And you get a printable character sheet at the end of it, which is awesome. And it stores your characters. That's another big thing.
Yeah.
Is you can go back to the character creator and tweak it after the fact. You don't have to rebuild your character every time. So, yeah. Well, there are just a couple things that I would like to highlight from the community. We had talked about this last episode of finding something on the DMs Guild that we wanted to talk about, but I'm going to expand it a little bit also to where we found some, or there's something on the DMs Guild we want to talk about, but I also found something in the D&D subreddit that I wanted to highlight and give a shout out to. And from the DMs Guild, it's pay what you want. So if you want to throw a couple bucks at it, if you really like it, you can. If you just want to snag it up for free, that's fine too. But it is the Gunslinger Marshall archetype, which is designed by everybody's favorite dungeon master / voice actor, Matthew Mercer, for his Critical Role campaign. But I like that he put the rules out there for other people to use. I know that the Gunslinger is a much beloved or much loathed class in Pathfinder. I think the Venn diagram of people that love the Gunslinger completely overlaps with players, and people that hate it overlaps with GMs. But maybe not. That may be unfair.
I like guns. I like guns.
Yeah, I just don't. It's
the, you know, it's the peanut butter and the chocolate thing. Do you like guns in your fantasy or not? That's Some people do.
Peanut butter and chocolate.
Yeah.
This is more like when you're at a family dinner and you can't get a new plate after dinner to get pie. And so you put your slice of like apple pie on the plate and there's still like a smudge of gravy that mixes in with the apple filling. That's what Gunslinger in Fantasy Worlds is like for me.
Mm-hmm.
Unexpected and not pleasant for me personally. Some people like it. But if you like the Gunslinger class and you have a gracious enough dungeon master that will let you play a Gunslinger, even though he may not personally like them, such as myself, then go check this out. You can check it out for free. A cool thing about the DM's Guild is if you pick something up that's pay what you want and you pick it up for free, you can go back into your library and give them money after the fact, which is really cool. And I mean, this is a fully fledged archetype. I mean, I would say fully fledged class. I mean, this is has a lot more meat to it than most archetypes do in the system. But you are introducing a whole new element. And they include firearms in the PDF, so you have some items to go off of that do have properties that play into the class, which is cool. I like that.
Yeah.
Any thoughts on the Gunslinger?
Having watched Critical Role for a long time now, it's pretty cool. It's clearly very heavily based on the Pathfinder class because Critical Role started in Pathfinder and then converted to 5th edition. And Talis and Jaffe playing Percy was already playing a Pathfinder Gunslinger. And then so Mercer basically created this to allow him to keep playing that character.
Yeah.
And I like it. He does a good job of putting some limitations on it. And I will say that this class strikes me as being very clearly designed for a world where there are very, very few gunslingers.
Yeah.
It might work in a Wild West era campaign, but I think it would need a little bit of tweaking and might be some things you would need to add as a GM. One thing that it just struck me is that a lot of people talk about Percy as really powerful. Like he can do just an absurd amount of damage. They went up against something the other night that was immune to non-magical damage. And Percy's a brilliant inventor, but he's not an enchanter. So mm-hmm. his gun became useless. And so things like that, there's ways to balance out the power of guns in a fantasy world, that just requires a little bit of creativity on the part of the DM. So,
okay. Philip, I'm going to send you an image in our Skype chat if you want to take a gander at that as I read the intro for this monster that was on the D&D subreddit. Little talk bubble up in the corner.
There it is. Oh, goodness.
All right. Carved out of flawless granite, Dwayne the Rock Gollum Johnson is the perfect representation of a flawless man. From his impeccable chiseled face to a body that lays the smack down on anyone who looks at it, there is not a single blemish on this magical construct of a man. Beyond being the most electrifying rock in sports entertainment, Dwayne the Rock Gollum Johnson is the cornerstone in a series of adventures best described as fast and furious. So yes, we have a monster called Dwayne the Rock Gollum Johnson, and please go to the D&D subreddit and look at the picture that I just sent Philip of this wonderful creation.
It's worth it for the art. Like that's hilarious.
But yes, it's a challenge rating 10 large construct with such wonderful attacks as Slam, the Rock Bottom, and the Pebble's Elbow. Yeah, I mean, it's fun. I think, here's the deal, because some of you may be hearing this and going, this totally would not fit into my campaign. And that may very well be true, but I think every campaign needs its moments of levity and good-natured fun. Philip and I's epic, long, kind of dark, serious campaign had the Avengers showing up to fight alongside the party.
Gaston from Beauty and the Beast was an important minor character when it was an important NPC in the game.
Yes, that's very true.
the song did make an appearance.
Yes. So finding those moments to have a lot of fun is, I would say, important. And your mileage may vary depending on your table. But even in something like Eberron Renewed, if you all were like tracking down an artifact in a quarry and all of a sudden this creature jumped out of nowhere, it would be a fun fight. Like, oh, it wouldn't take away from the tone of the campaign. It would be a fun moment for everyone. And then you move on with the campaign. Or you have a great new friend that will follow you around and talk smack to anybody that wants to step up and fight you. So, yeah, I spotted that today, before I went into work and just couldn't help myself.
Yeah, that's awesome.
The creators of this monster are the Dungeon Rats. If you go to thedungeonrats.com and look at their blog, they have a lot of stuff like this. So definitely go check it out. And I get the sense just scrolling through their blog that we may be revisiting this website for some more hilarious monsters to come. So yeah. All right, Philip. Let's go ahead, and we came in under 30 minutes, so let's get into the main topic of the show.
All right. This one was suggested by my lovely wife, Kelly, so credit to her. I observed the other day that I played differently as a player, that I behave differently from other players because I am a GM. And she suggested that would be an interesting topic of discussion, and I suggested it to Eric. And he thought it was a cool one. So here we go. We're going to talk about being a GM who is also a player. Eric and I don't get very many opportunities to come out from behind the screen. I probably more than Eric. But when we do, we like it a lot. And so we're going to talk a little bit tonight about how that affects us as a player. And what are some ways that if you find that opportunity to get out from behind the screen, what are some things you can do to make sure that you have a good time and that whoever sits in for you as the GM is also having a good time?
You've created a monster in your own image of somebody that wants to get behind the screen and be that level of a glutton for punishment. But you've also made DMing look easy enough to where someone else feels like they can give it a shot. And the last thing you want to do is after one session them going, well, clearly this isn't for me, get back behind the screen. Because that I think is something that all Dungeon Masters want. I mean, somebody had to be the first DM, and I bet they wanted nothing more than to be able to play for a few sessions and not have to plan everything out. So you definitely want to encourage at every opportunity other people DMing for you, and you want to be known as a good player, because playing D&D is a lot of fun. I mean, I love running games, but I mean, it's probably been over 2 years since I've gotten to play D&D, which bums me out. I begged Philip to run Eberron Renewed so I could just play, and he said no. So
yeah, I was running two other games already. Oh.
We think this is an important discussion to have, because as we've talked about on the show before, Philip and I co-GM, so we were kind of constantly every few sessions hopping back and forth and having to be a good player in the other's campaign, even though it was the same campaign. But yeah, I mean, it's really easy, and we're going to highlight some of the pitfalls that come into play when a GM gets out from behind the screen and how to best avoid them. So, Philip, where do you want to start the discussion off?
I think probably starting with what you just said, what are some things that GMs often do when they get out from behind the screen that probably we shouldn't? What are some bad habits to avoid, some pitfalls to dodge that will make you a better player and will hopefully encourage whoever has stepped in to want to keep going? Because yeah, the world needs more people to run D&D. The ratio of people willing to run D&D to people willing to play D&D is deeply unbalanced, people.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I've met people who have like three or four friends and they want to play D&D, but they can't find anybody to run a game for them. And my first question to them is, why don't one of you run the game? And it's such a daunting notion to them. Like, no, we're not DMs. We're players. And anybody can be a DM. It seems far more difficult than it actually is. But one of the things that I see a lot of GMs or DMs who step from behind the screen and are playing in a game, like at Gamer Nation Con, the gaming convention that D20 Radio puts out or puts on every year. I mean, that is, I would say, 90% DMs and GMs getting to play for the first time that year, because it's like, oh, yes. there are other people that want to run games. So we've talked about this in terms of being a good player, and it still holds true here. You never want to tell another player what to do with their turn. And your instinct may be to help guide them because you are a DM who has a lot of experience playing with new players and guiding them through their turn and being like, okay, well, what if you did this? And that it's a very different situation when you're out from behind that screen. That's not your job. Now, that's not to say you shouldn't do it at all, because if you have a new DM, like one of your players is DMing for the first time, they may be still getting their legs under them. So you just want to give the DM at your table first chance to do it. And then if things just grind to an absolute halt, speak up. Because if you are the DM stepping out from behind the screen, you might be the most experienced person at the table. And so you might need to step up in that way, but it should not be your go-to knee-jerk reaction.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would say that another thing to avoid is, and this is a really hard one, don't be the rules lawyer at your table.
Yeah.
As the experienced DM, you probably know the rules better than anyone else. And at some point, someone, the person who took over is going to play it wrong. I'm in a game right now with someone who's much more used to Pathfinder and occasionally just runs it by Pathfinder rules about something. And my instinct is to correct it, but no, that's not my job, right? If it's going to cause a problem, then we can ask. And if someone asks, hey, what's the rule on this? And you know, then yeah, sure. But don't raise your hand, call a point of order and say, no, you're doing it wrong. Not so much because that's always a bad thing to do, but mostly in that particular context, it's going to be discouraging to the new GM. You want to give that person some breathing room, and you need to remember that when you started running, you didn't know the rules, and you screwed up the rules, and everyone still had a good time.
And a big thing with stuff like this, and my general rule of thumb, because I can already hear some of you pushing back in your heads of like, well, it's just me being helpful and making sure that the game is played as intended. And that's fine if that is your intention. But I can almost assure you that at least one person at the table, if not everybody at the table, is not going to think of it in those terms. And so I wouldn't do anything in regards to rules or correcting other people unsolicited.
Yeah.
If somebody asks the question, feel free to answer. And it's important here to distinguish asks the table. If somebody turns to the GM and says, hey, what is this mean or what does this do? Once again, give them a chance to do their job. If they don't know and they say, I don't know, maybe like this is going to sound kind of simple and juvenile, but raise your hand, like just gesture at the GM and say, well, I can help you out if you want. Or if you just want to make a call here, that's fine. And just do it that way.
Mm-hmm.
Tread lightly.
One thing I will sometimes do, especially if I've got someone who's a new GM, and I don't want to, I don't know, sound like I'm talking down to them, because that's, you know, when you know more than the other person about a particular topic, it's easy to sound pedantic. Is I'll offer to look it up. Even if I feel pretty confident that I know what the rule is, I'll say, you want me to look it up? And
yeah,
then I'll look it up. Because I might be wrong too.
What? You?
Yes, even me. I think another thing that I'm inclined to do, and I do this with any form of storytelling, and so it's not meant unkindly, but when I'm watching TV or reading a book, I'll think about it this way, and sometimes I fall into it with D&D as well. I will want to talk about how I would have done it.
Yeah.
And, you know, like, oh, wow, that thing we just did, I feel like we really missed an opportunity for some cool storytelling with this thing that we didn't highlight. That's easy. That's good conversation if we're talking about the most recent episode of Game of Thrones. But don't say that about the person who's running the game.
Yeah, I had this moment of laughing to myself, like, what do you mean the two guys that created a D&D podcast to tell other people how they think the game should be played have issues with talking to people about how the game should be played? What?
This is, I guess, not a bad habit to avoid, but I guess we can transition this perhaps into things you should do. Jump on that plot hook.
Mm-hmm.
Man, you've been there. You've presented this cool NPC that you spent a lot of time thinking about, and everyone at the table just kind of ignores them.
Yeah.
Or doesn't take up the offered quest that you're kind of trying because everyone's like, be the guy who just takes it up, unless it's entirely contrary to your character's nature. Be the guy who will pick up the stray thread, but also be the guy who's willing to move on when it's obvious the GM is ready to move on.
Yeah, I mean, this is kind of transitioning to things you should do. But I agree, you as a GM or DM at the table probably have the highest level of awareness as to what's really going on at the table because you have the most experience in dealing with it. And you shouldn't block that out of your mind. You should use that to your and the new DM's advantage. And we're talking a lot about playing for a new DM, but just to the DM's advantage. Because, like Philip said, you've been there. I can think of a time when I was playing in Philip's game, and I mean, we've talked about on this show, the Dreadfort, when everything just went horribly awry. But the thing is that I knew where Philip wanted it to go, so it seemed a little bit less organic for me to railroad them. Mm-hmm. It was a different situation. But if I had just been a player, I feel like I would have been able to tell that going up was not what Philip wanted us to do, and maybe tried to nudge the party in the right direction. You should absolutely not railroad the rest of the party and say, well, I'm going to go this way. You all deal with it.
Yeah, don't do that.
Yeah. But go talk to that NPC that the DM spent three times as long describing as literally everything else in the scene. Because a lot of players won't. Or go search the ornately designed desk that practically has a spotlight shining on it. When one of the other players is incessantly interrogating a prisoner and the dungeon master has repeated himself three times now when the player keeps asking him different questions, suggest to the party, I think he's done talking. Because that will take a lot of pressure off the DM to make it easier for them to run a good game.
Yeah, basically, sort of the overarching idea here is be the DM's guy at the table. Like, have the DM's back as a player. Eric and I kind of touch on this idea of co-DMing a lot. But that was, I think, my favorite thing about co-DMing is I could talk to Eric about, in broad strokes, about what the next adventure was. And we could talk a little bit about how that was going to affect each of our characters and allow your character to be a story prop, essentially.
Yeah.
Build the character you want. This is a bad habit I have that I would say where you can be assertive. I have a tendency to, when we're all deciding, what's everyone want to play, to go, Oh, well, everyone pick, and then I'll see what we need.
Yeah.
If you don't get to play much, don't do that. Declare what you want to play, right? Play what you want to play. But use the story aspect of your character as much as you can to help out your new DM.
Yeah. Well, and the other thing is, like, if you rarely get to play and you're getting to hop in with the same group for like many arcs, you're going to end up playing the same thing over and over and over, because the other players are going to keep picking what they want to pick. So yeah, I mean, you declaring, no, I'm going to be the paladin this time, that'll shake things up to the point where hopefully the other players at the table will try new things and be the change you wish to see at the table, I guess is what I'm trying to say.
Or the changeling you wish to see at the table.
Yeah. No, and Philip touched on it with be the DM's guy at the table. And that goes heavily into just being supportive of them in pretty much every, you should never be the antagonistic one. You should never, never, those of you listening to Eberron Renewed, you can give the stink eye to Philip. You should never try to outsmart the DM just because you're a fellow DM.
That's not why I tried to outsmart. I was trying to outsmart I genuinely thought, I did not think I was outsmarting you. I genuinely thought that you knew what I was doing and you decided, okay, that was good, I'll give it to him. I kept waiting for you to ask me to roll deception.
Yeah. No, if you all listening to Eberron Renewed, Philip had me on my heels during the interrogation scene against the Swords of Liberty, playing his mind games. But anyway, and that was me just poking fun at Philip. I was totally fine and in total control, and the guy was feeding him false information the whole time. But especially if you have a new DM, but just in general, never try to outsmart your DM. Because that's not going to be fun for them. It's not going to be fun for the other players. And yeah, it might be fun for you, but as a DM, you should know that that's not the right mentality. If you just wanted it to be fun for you, then your party probably would have left a long time ago. So yeah, just that's what you can do. That's the biggest function you can serve, is being the second person at the table trying to make sure that everybody is having a good time. Your role and how you do that is different, but you can still accomplish that from the player's seat. One last pitfall that I want to touch on, because it's something that I struggle with literally daily, if not hourly, with having Philip being a player in Eberron Renewed. You need to resist the innate urge, and this is for both sides, but specifically for if you are running a game for another GM, you have to resist the urge to run stuff by them, unless you are a co-DM situation like Philip and I were in, where we were both running the story. Like, there have been so many times when I've had an idea for a plot hook or the next chapter of Eberron Renewed, and all I want to do, because I got to spend over 3 years brainstorming with him, I want to call my writing buddy Philip and say, hey, I just had this great idea, what do you think? Because while Philip wouldn't be angry at me for doing that, and he would probably still find some enjoyment at the table, it takes away his ability to be surprised by the story that I'm telling. And that's something that I really enjoy as a player, is getting to get lost in the story and trying to figure out what's going on, especially when I'm playing in the game of somebody that I know really well. Like, if you were writing a campaign whole cloth, Philip, mm-hmm. and I was getting to play in it, I would find a lot of enjoyment trying to decipher, based on what I know about you and how you write stories and how you craft stories, trying to figure out where things are going. And that would, of course, set you up to pull a rug out from under me, because you buck expectations.
Yeah.
And so you lose so much. Eberron Renewed would have lost so much if, from the outset, I told Philip the overarching narrative idea that I had. Because right now, Philip is totally lost in a lot of it. Like,
it's very true.
He doesn't know what's going on. And I think we both enjoy that. We both enjoy that aspect of it. So that's something that I struggle with a lot, and I would encourage those of you to remain strong. And I mean, if you have a dungeon master outside of your game that you want to bounce ideas off of, go for it.
Yeah, yeah.
But just avoid doing it with people that are in your game.
Yeah, I will say that the flip side of that, from the perspective of someone who is playing in another GM's game, is I kind of touched on this earlier, but let the other GM use your character as a story. Be okay with giving over control of some things to the other GM. The reason I say that, we mentioned this in our tips for players episode, but this is particularly true when you're a GM. The reason is this. Probably your play style is someone who wants to make the game more fun for everyone, who wants to make the story better. Not everyone's play style is that. Some people care a lot about their character getting a really happy ending and getting all sorts of good things happening to them. And that's okay. They have an emotional attachment to their character, and that's normal. As a fellow GM, something you hopefully are able to do for the person who's now running the game, now that you've stepped out and have become a player, is to not be that way with your character. Those of you who have been listening to Eberron Renewed know that Beric is really not having a good time right now. Beric is being run around, and he doesn't know what's going on in a lot of ways. People keep being imperious to him when they have no right to be, or and like just being dismissive of his moral worldview.
Yeah.
And that's hideously frustrating to Beric. I don't mind. Philip's okay. Like, I'm not upset by any of this. And I think the other players at our table wouldn't mind either if this was happening to them. But I know that Eric feels confident being that way with Beric because he knows that I understand that he's making story, not just picking on me. And
50-50.
Well, probably, especially if you play it with a group of friends, most people are going to know that as well. Sometimes, especially if you've been playing a character for a long time, that line starts to feel a little blurred.
Yeah.
So as a GM who's playing with in a game run by your fellow GM, be the person who the GM doesn't have to worry about that with. Be the person that they don't have to think, oh, is this going to mess up me and Philip? I killed my best friend's character in our big long campaign right after she had accomplished her life's ambition.
Yep.
I didn't set out to do it. It's just how it fell out. And he was actually mad for a little bit. I understand why, and gave him his space, and we need to do an episode on character death and talk about that. But try to be the person that your fellow GM is not going to have to worry about that with.
Yeah. And I mean, I think it goes back to being the support system, for lack of a better term, at the table for your DM. But it's also just be game for whatever. When you first embark on a campaign, unless you've had a really extensive session zero, you may not know exactly what you're getting yourself into in terms of what type of adventure, what tone. I mean, with Eberron Renewed, none of them did. We didn't have a session zero. Everybody brought characters to the table and we went. And I knew that Philip, being the most experienced person at the table when we started playing, would be game for whatever. Like, whatever I threw at him, he was going to find a way to make it interesting and find some way to make it enjoyable for both of us. And so that's something that you can be for your fellow dungeon masters, is just be that person that they know is game for whatever. I think that those are the biggest things that are benefits that you can bring to the table. And also, if you are a DM with another dungeon master at the table, can be a benefit for you.
Yeah, I would encourage you to think about it that way, because I know if you're GMing, especially if you're new at it, and there's the other dungeon master at the table there, that can feel intimidating. And I know that I had a tendency when I started. Now, I had the benefit of the other GMs in my gaming group at the time. We're all new. We all started new.
Yeah.
None of us knew what we were doing. But then we got Randy started playing with us, and Randy's really experienced. And I know that when that happened, I had this tendency to kind of glance at him to look to see if he was reacting weirdly to what I was doing, to see if I was doing this right. Yeah. So it can be intimidating. I would encourage you not to think about it that way. Think about that person as a resource, as someone who knows what you're experiencing and understands and wants you to succeed.
But inversely, and I will speak to the people that are stepping out from behind the screen, don't be the kind of dungeon master that intimidates people. That's the whole reason we're having this episode. Don't be a jerk. We all know it. You're smart. You know the rules. You've been playing D&D for a lot of years. Shut up. We get it. Just play the game and enjoy it. Because that's the thing. Like, playing at Gamer Nation Con has opened my eyes up to so many other issues that come about. Like, and I love everybody.
Now we're going to list the people that Eric doesn't like playing with at Gamer Nation Con.
No, and it's not like I like the people. When we sit around and talk about Star Wars or comic books or whatever, they're fun conversations. But there's just little things that some of them do at the table, like that are just maddening. And that's not the type of player that you want to be. And a lot of it comes down to correcting, like we talked about near the top of this episode when we started talking about the main section. Like, don't be the DM that corrects, or don't be the player that corrects the DM, especially if you're a fellow DM, because that's just going to up that anxiety and that level of intimidation. Like, oh, well, now I know if I do screw up, they're going to call me out on it in front of everybody else. Great. That sounds like fun. So yeah, don't do that. Resist that urge. Like I said, raise your hand, wait to be called on. don't really do that. But yeah, I mean, just, it is intimidating. And a lot of people, it's been so long ago since you first started doing this. And I think where the issue comes in is it was many editions ago. Like, if you got your start in AD&D, and that's where you really found your legs and got used to DMing, once time came for 3rd edition, 3.5, 4th, 5e, you knew enough about the game to understand the system. And so you never really had to struggle with that system. So like Philip and I, we cut our teeth on 4e. So when I decided I wanted to GM 5e, it took me a week of looking at the system to be like, oh, okay, I get it, and able to run a game. So there's a tendency there to lose a certain level of empathy for new dungeon masters, because you picked up on 5e so easily. Why didn't they? Well, it's because they didn't learn 4e. It's the new system for them. And so just try to have some empathy. Think back to whatever edition it was that you screwed up royally, because we all did. The way that I ran 4E would probably make Chris Perkins want to drop kick me in the head. but here I am now doing 5E. I think doing it all right. But I try to never forget, hashtag never forget, when I learned 4E. and when I learned Pathfinder, because that was equally as daunting. And so, yeah, just have that empathy. Understand that they are trying to expand their abilities, expand their knowledge, and take some of the pressure off you. Once again, I cannot say it enough. You want to encourage this behavior because it means you get to play more and you want to play more. We all want to play more. I never get to play. even at Gamer Nation Con, I only got to play Star Wars. I didn't get to play D&D. I ran D&D. It's all I do now. so anyway, you may feel like we're telling you to sit on your hands, not be yourself, whatever. And that's couldn't be more true. You're a terrible person.
I was going to make that joke. I was queuing it up.
No, that's not the case. We don't think that you're terrible. Like we are speaking from a position of knowing these impulses because we've had them at the table. And that's where we're coming from with this, is based on our experience of co-GMing, doing this for 3 straight years, but doing it with somebody that we trust. And we, Philip and I, were able to have conversations of like, hey, you did this at the table and this is how I felt about it. And like, oh, okay. And so we know, I think outside of every other topic that we've talked about on this show, this is the one that Philip and I know is how to be a GM and a player and reconcile those two sides of yourself. And yeah, be yourself, play the type of character you want to play, but just support the DM in what they're trying to do and let them make mistakes as much as it may pain you for them to get the grappling rules wrong, or for them to forget to roll a concentration check.
You feel strongly about grappling. That's always your example.
Because the rules in Pathfinder are so convoluted and stupid. it's a holdover from those days when I never wanted to grapple anybody because it was just the worst. But anyway, like, let them forget to make constitution checks. Let them mess up initiative order. Let them, like, I still do it all the time. I forget to roll for my NPC that I'm controlling to help out the party. It's not until like 2 rounds in that I'm like, oh crap, Krast is here and should be fighting also. And I don't say anything. I just quietly roll my die behind the screen, insert him in, and Philip probably notices, but he doesn't say anything. And so, you know, I feel like I've pulled one over on everybody. So yeah, let them make mistakes because you still do, right, Philip?
Yep.
I mean, I don't, but Philip does.
All right. Well, let's shift to what I think will probably be the sort of lighter and funny top side of this. What are some ways in which being a GM changes the way you are as a player in any systems? You know, you said you got to play some Star Wars at Gamer Nation Con, or back when we played Pathfinder that Randy ran or things like that. What are some ways that being an experienced GM affects the way you are as a player?
I mean, my jokey answer, you bringing up Star Wars, is being a GM affected me as a player in that I understood the rules, because when I first read through the rules, it's like, I don't know what this means. but then having to run it, I was like, oh, okay, I get it now. No, actually, it was listening to the Order 66 podcast helped me, which is also on the D20 Radio Podcasting Network. Go check them out. There was a second free plug for you guys.
Nice.
So, no, I think for me, it's kind of what we've touched on. Like, it made my awareness at the table skyrocket to where I see the Matrix sort of thing. I can see what's building the world. And some people may think that's sad that I can't, quote unquote, get lost in a game anymore, but that's not true. But I understand what the DM is trying to accomplish in those moments. Not saying I know where they're going and the story is spoiled for me, but I understand what I need to do in a scene to make it good. And
yeah,
I think that's what's affected me most is, and I like to think it's made the tables that I play at better because I understand this is a communal thing and we just want to tell a good story. And so I think it was so evident at Philip and I talked about this a few episodes back, back in April when we went to Gamer Nation Con, like that game that we played in of Star Wars that had the like super dark, sad ending. That table was like 90% GMs who understood not everything has to be happy for it to be fun. And it was one of the most fulfilling games we've ever played in. And it was all GMs who can see the code and understand, okay, if I do this here, this is going to be more interesting. It's not going to be necessarily better, but it's going to be interesting.
Yeah.
So,
I think a way that it affects me, and this is kind of silly, but this is the context in which my wife suggested this episode topic. I have a tendency to play my characters in a way that I suspect might get them killed.
Yeah.
And usually only characters that are established and that I've thoroughly gotten to explore. The reason for that is character death early in a campaign is fairly boring, in my opinion, because you don't know the character, no one's emotionally invested in the character, the death is just inconvenient, really, because now you have to build a new character, and you didn't get to play that character as long as you wanted.
It's the guy that dies in the opening scene of a movie. It's like, oh, okay. It gives a sense of like how dangerous the bad guys are, but that's about it.
Yeah. But once I've got a character well established and I feel like people like him and I like him, I have a tendency to play in a way that will possibly lead to his death. And the reason for this is simple. I like character death in a campaign. I think it's interesting. I don't know of any novels that I really love where all of the major characters live.
Are you counting Boromir as a character death?
I'm counting Boromir as a major character.
Okay, it was just
Boromir's a major character.
It was real. It was like level five max. I mean,
but additionally, to the point you were making about the one shot we got to run in, I don't think we get to say that Frodo actually gets to come home.
Yeah,
like. So anyway, the books I really love, the movies I really love, usually there's some character that's going to die heroically. Now, dying mundanely and in a boring way is stupid. But
yeah.
And so I'm not like, you know, running around trying to get my characters killed by behaving stupidly. But I tend to play characters who aren't likely to run from a fight, who are likely to be the one to hold the door to. Yeah, I know, right? because as a GM, I like player death as a story element.
Yeah.
And I'm almost always using my character to do anything I can to make the story better. I think also I have a tendency, I have gotten better about this. I probably didn't do this when I first started playing, but I've gotten better, I think, because I'm a GM at building character backstories that are useful and in not any way hindering to the GM.
Yeah.
I think Beric is a good example of this. You kind of told me the theme of this campaign and some of the things that it would have to do with. And I built Beric to be just a character who would get involved in that. I didn't give him an elaborate backstory or an agenda, even. He's trying to understand the power that he's got. That doesn't call on him to go any particular place. What I don't do, and this this was our fault, but story from the Unfinished Wars, the epic campaign. I don't remember what level we did this at, but at some point we thought, you know what we should do? We should ask everyone, all six players, what they want their character's final fate to be.
Yeah.
That was a dumb idea.
Mm-hmm.
There's a form of that conversation that's useful, but the one we had was not. And so we had a player tell us, well, I really think it'd be cool if my character founded a religion. I really think it'd be cool. I really want my character to be the King Arthur of their people, to come and restore the kingdom. I really want my, you know, this, that, and the other.
Yeah.
Or the best answer, my character really like to open a bar That was my favorite answer. But that put a lot of, for the record, we pulled that off.
Yeah.
But that put a lot of onus on requiring us to then shape the story to fit that, which we did, and I think did well. But it was hard, and at some points, I didn't know how we were going to do it. And so in general, with my characters now, I try not to do that. I try not to give my character a grand destiny.
Mm-hmm. Let the grand destiny be defined by what happens over the course of the campaign. Because, I mean, honestly, pretty much any grand destiny you want, forming a religion, ascending to some form of ruling class or royalty, it can, like, a lot of different experiences can fit that grand destiny. And so, including death, like, I cannot think of a better way for a character to found a religion than to die.
Yeah.
And then people over idealize the type of person your character was and create this cult of personality. Like, so don't go into it with anything in mind. But at the same time, if you think, I have a cleric, something I'd like to see and I think it would be fun is forming a religion, don't force the issue. Let the campaign happen. Let it come at you. And 8 out of 10 times, I would say, you'll find some way to at least form some form of religion. So,
yeah, I think that about covers it.
Okay. Well, we certainly hope that you have enjoyed this episode of The Knowledge Check, where we gave you some tips on being a good player as a dungeon master. And yeah, I mean, just creating a fun environment at your table. Philip and I are constantly dealing with some of the bad habits that we've talked about. And I mean, everybody trips up from time to time. It's just important that you recognize what you did and you move forward and you try to do better. So, yeah, well, I think that's it for this episode. But I just want to say thank you all so much for listening, and thank you for your patience in just us getting a new feel for the schedule and releasing and stuff like that. So hopefully things are going to get easier soon, but just, you know, life sometimes has to take precedent.
Indeed.
So, yeah. But thank you so much for listening to the Knowledge Check podcast. Once again, I am one of your hosts, Eric.
And I'm Philip.
And we'll see you next time.
Bye-bye.